Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your patience and holding. We now have your presenters in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will open the floor for your questions. At that time, instructions will be given as to the procedure to follow if you would like to ask an audio question. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's first speaker, Mr. Adam Davidson.
Hi, this is Adam Davidson. I write the On Money column at the New York Times Magazine, and I'm co-founder of NPR's Planet Money, and very excited to be joined by Robert Kahn, who is a senior fellow for international economics at Council on Foreign Relations. You can also go to his blog, Macro and Markets, on the CFR website. Sebastian Malaby has exactly the same title. He is also senior fellow for international economics at the Council on Foreign Relations and also blogs frequently. And I'm going to, Rob, start with you. I'd love a quickish kind of overview of where we are right now. I have covered the Greece crisis sometimes intensely, sometimes not at all, over the last 5 years, and it just feels like Groundhog's Day. I'm just we seem to have been in a steady state of Greece is about to leave the euro. They need some desperate negotiation with the Europeans, and it's not clear if it's going to happen or not. Can you kind of paint the picture? Where are we now? How is it different from each one of the last 5 years? Can you walk us through that?
Well, I think your Groundhog Day analogy is not a bad one to start with. You know, since 2010, we've had a series of adjustment programs that have been supported by the IMF, the ECB, and the European Commission. Those programs have all performed pretty poorly, measured both by the reforms that got put in place and also the ability to restart growth. The 2012 program that provided for a private sector debt restructuring set the targets that we lived with until the beginning of this year. And that program anticipated a return to growth and a 3% primary surplus in 2015. And I think over the course of last year, it became increasingly clear that program wasn't going to achieve those targets and some significant rethinking was required. Politics overtook that in January of this year when the Syriza party was elected and rejected the orthodoxy embodied in that program and adopted a very approach really in opposition to these policies, and have tried in fits and starts to renegotiate since then. Facing some significant maturities against a weakening economy and new policies that have essentially moved it to primary deficit, what we've seen is a government that has been increasingly scrambling to raise money, not just for external debt payments, but to meet domestic financial obligations and domestic fiscal obligations. And they've done so through one-off tax holidays, through draining money from state and local accounts and state enterprise accounts, and also through very significant arrears. And it's been pretty clear that that process was going to reach the end of the road around now. And so the end-month payments to the IMF and also pension and wage payments domestically really have become a focal point for the negotiations. There has been some talk of progress made in terms of headline numbers, in terms of what kind of primary surplus to look for. The Europeans have reduced the primary surplus targets they're asking for. They're now looking for a primary surplus of 1% this year and rising more slowly up to something like 3.5% in 2017. So there is, at least in principle, some significant concession there. The Greeks would say that they've met those numbers, they've agreed to meet those, but if you actually look at the policies that each side are proposing behind these numbers, there's extraordinarily wide differences in what they're proposing to do. And the IMF believes that the policies the Greeks are proposing would produce probably a primary deficit, perhaps as much as 1% of GDP, maybe something smaller. And so there is a significant gap to be closed, something like 2% of GDP in new measures this year, if there is to be a deal. And that would involve pretty material cuts in pensions, wages, and market opening that really crosses fundamental red lines that this government was elected on. So we have. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
So I was just going to say, so we've had a series of meetings that really have produced no progress. We had today a meeting of finance ministers. It just concluded. There apparently was no progress made on that. We probably will have, if not this weekend, on next week, have a meeting of leaders with sort of one final grasp. But it's hard not to conclude that we are going to go through the end of the month without a deal, which will mean that Greece will miss a payment to the IMF, and may well be heading into an environment with some significant controls domestically and really an intensification of the crisis.
Great. Not great that is happening, but great answer. And I should note for the people on the line, I'm just going to ask a couple more questions, and then we are going to open it to you. So, and David will come on the operator in a few minutes and explain how you can get in the queue to ask your question. So, Sebastian, I guess the question I'm most tempted to ask is basically, is now the time I should dig back in and really care about this, or am I, you know, can I kind of ignore Greece for another 5 years and dive in 2020 and see where it is at that point? Or are we reaching an endpoint? And what are the various endpoints we might be reaching?
Well, I think Rob's analysis, brilliantly points you to the fact that you need to start focusing on this, Adam. And if you haven't already, you know, shame on you, because this really is, I think the moment of truth approaching. If they, there's no strong reason, I don't think, to believe that they're going to get their act together and pay the IMF at the end of the month. And then if they don't, we're into another series of repayment deadlines. They're supposed to have been paying bondholders a couple of times in the first fortnight or so of July, and then there's a big payment to the European Central Bank on July 20th. So I think the next 3 weeks or so are going to be critical. And what's going to happen, I think, is that without getting new external aid from the outside creditors, the Greeks don't have the cash to pay back what they owe. And at some point along this line, one of two things is going to trigger a dramatic break in this story. One thing that might happen is that the European Central Bank, which has been propping up the Greek banks by providing liquidity to them through the Greek Central Bank, will start to squeeze that down or even cut it off. The European Central Bank is supposed to provide a sort of liquidity window, like the discount window that the Fed has in the U.S. Provided that it's lending to a solvent bank against decent collateral, and it's going to be harder and harder to argue that the collateral which the Greek banks provide, which is basically Greek government bonds, is decent quality if the Greeks aren't paying back what they owe on those same bonds, right? So at some point it becomes harder and harder for the European Central Bank to keep on propping up the Greek banks. And in anticipation of the possibility that the ECB might pull the plug on the Greek banks, you're going to have depositors in Greece being justifiably terrified that their money is in these Greek banks and may not be retrievable if the banks go under. So you're going to see capital flight as people pull euros out of Greek banks and move it outside. Now, it's already happened. There have been periods of panic in this story in the past where the volume of withdrawals has been quite high. We've had another sort of spike in the volume just in the last few days. But if that reaches a critical point, you have a bank run. So that's another way that you could trigger essentially a banking collapse in Greece. And if you do get the banking collapse, then I think you start to see the measures. There won't necessarily be, it won't be a headline, we the government of Greece hereby leave the euro, but it will be measures that amount to creating a separate currency. So you could have a freezing of deposits in Greek banks to prevent the bank run. So now all of a sudden a deposit in a Greek bank might be called a euro, but it sure isn't the same as having a deposit in a Dutch bank or a German bank where you can take the euro out and spend it. So there'll be different classes of euro then in the euro system. Equally, to prop up the banks if they're in danger of going under, the Greek government may be forced into printing a sort of domestic IOU, some form of scrip, which, again, would mean that there'd be a de facto extra currency in circulation. So I think it's sort of it's a crab-like crawl sideways over the precipice, not a dramatic single moment. But this is the moment, Adam, to focus on it.
Adam, let me just add one footnote to Sebastian's point on the ECB's dilemma here in terms of providing this extraordinary liquidity. So I think they have provided an additional 1.1 billion euros this week, but they've had deposit outflows apparently well in excess of that already this week. And it's not, and in addition to the collateral problem that Sebastian mentioned and this sort of deposit outflow, there's also an issue that non-performing loans appear to be spiking quite dramatically. I think it's understandable that some borrowers have decided not to pay back, either because their economic conditions are dire or because they simply hope that the bank may not be there in a week or two and then they can avoid having to pay. But for whatever reasons, it's going to be increasingly hard not to make the judgment that these banks are insolvent. And once that judgment is made, the ECB will be forced by its rules to cut off this emergency liquidity. I think there's actually some forbearance already being in place right now. I think it's going to be increasingly hard for the ECB to continue to make the kind of positive judgment to keep the money flowing.
And so Rob, when you think through that worst-case scenario, who outside of Greece is going to feel the pain most acutely? And, you know, I'm certainly curious about those of us here in the U.S., but also, you know, peripheral mm-hmm. European countries or Central European countries. Is it going to be the financial sector in the U.S. that's yeah. going to be hit hardest, or trade-sensitive sectors? How do you see that playing out?
Well, a couple of points. First, in terms of Europe, I've argued that while Europe is much better prepared for this than in 2010, 2011, that the markets are underpricing the kind of contagion we'll see. Where will we see it? Probably not in government bond spreads. Remember that the ECB right now, as part of their quantitative easing program, are buying up very significant amounts of European government bonds. And while spreads have risen, it's not been the kind of spike we've seen in previous crises. I think the ECB's purchase plan will sort of hide the contagion through those channels. I think where you'll see it is in the things they're not buying, which could be equities, bank debt, and other sort of higher risk assets in the Eurozone. I think you'll see a flight to quality out of Europe, so I think it's probably dollar positive. Which can be good or bad, depending on what you think of the current strength of the dollar. In terms of the U.S., you know, the direct effects are relatively modest in terms of trade. Obviously, as Greece is quite small, there is a concern about global growth and its implications for, in particular, Federal Reserve decision making at this sort of delicate time. And so, certainly, if you believe that a Greek crisis would cause a broader retrenchment in Europe, a decline in confidence and a decline in growth prospects, you could tell a story in which the direct trade effects could be significant for the U.S., but otherwise they're relatively modest. So the worries probably are more in the financial channels. If a Greek crisis, because of the losses that it forces recognition of around the world, particularly in Europe, leads to some contagion of financial distress, certainly you could see that reflected in financial conditions in the U.S., offset by the safe haven effect I mentioned earlier. So certainly you saw in Janet Yellen's comments yesterday a concern, but these kind of effects could well be second order compared to what Europe's facing.
Right, got you. And Sebastian, a question I've had throughout this crisis, and it reminds me of the discussion around our own housing crisis, are there clear villains here? You know, is this a story of wildly irresponsible Greek governments that are now being even more irresponsible, or is this really a story of predatory German banks taking advantage of naive Greeks back over a decade ago and now refusing to pay the cost? And I guess a secondary but related question is, is this actually a rational process? Are the Greeks being reasonably sophisticated that the best way to get a good deal is to freak everybody out and make them as scared as possible? So even if they do plan to, quote-unquote, do the right thing. They really want to pretend like they won't to get the best deal possible. Or are people being kind of nuts? And if so, who's being nuts? And how are they being self-destructive?
So on the question of whether this is a rational scare tactic to be followed by a miraculous climb down and a deal, I'm betting against that. I think that we're too near to the deadline. The absolutely last time will be this heads of state meeting that people are now talking about in the next few days or so. But if there's going to be a breakthrough, that's where it would be. But I haven't, I've talked to people who are relatively close to these negotiations, and I just don't hear that from them. I hear instead a sense of sort of despair and chaos that the personal relationships between the Greek leader Tsipras and his counterparts elsewhere in Europe, the relationship between Varoufakis, the finance minister, and his counterparts has just turned poisonous, and that's never good for getting a rational outcome. So I don't think this is a sort of rational calculation. It is true that Varoufakis made his career before as a game theory economist, but I think he's misplayed this game quite badly. There's a view, of course, that, maybe he is playing a sensible game because, in fact, Greece would be better off if it did leave the euro, and that, you could wipe the slate clean, renege on all that nasty foreign debt, and devalue your currency so you suddenly get a competitive position for Greece in exports, notably in tourism, and that Greece would be a whole lot better off if it went that route. And you've seen that being argued in plenty of sort of commentary that one sees on Greece. I think that's sort of fundamentally mistaken for the reason that the view that leaving could be managed cleanly to produce a better outcome supposes that, Greece has a very functional state. And if it had a very functional government, we wouldn't be in this position in the first place. I mean, the fact that they haven't been able to stick with the program, Ireland and Spain and Portugal have done much better managing their way through austerity and difficulty, may tell you something about the starting position, that Greece had worse debts. But I think it also tells you a lot about the quality of the government and the quality of the ability of the government machinery to collect taxes, to get around corruption and so forth. And that's the problem. So if you had a departure of Greece from the Eurozone, do you really think that they would go through the technical challenge of introducing a whole new national currency cleanly? And therefore you could devalue it cleanly and get all that competitiveness benefit, efficiently? I don't think so for a moment. I think they would be flailing around, it would be chaotic, and that chaos would be rather long-lived. Equally, I don't think that the Greeks would renege on all that foreign debt suddenly and say, we're not paying anyone in the international community, goodbye. That would imply losing membership of the International Monetary Fund after a while. I don't think they would want to go that far. So I don't think that this sort of wipe the slate clean idea, I think, is also oversold. So I think there's a lot of risk here for the Greeks. There's also some risk for the European partners, because even if some of the contagion will be suppressed, as Rob was saying, because the European Central Bank will buy sovereign bonds in Spain and Portugal and so forth, and create the firewall that prevents contagion. There can be other kinds of contagion through, Rob mentioned equities, but I would mention political contagion. You don't want Europe to have to deal with a Greece that is a member of NATO, but all of a sudden hates the West and is cozying up to Russia. So that's a sort of different kind of cost from a Greek exit. So I think, in other words, both sides have a lot to lose. It's not rational for them to want to leave. I think it's gone beyond the point where they're simply bluffing and they're going to turn around and do a deal. So I'm rather pessimistic about the next 3 weeks or so.
Okay. Well, on that depressing note, let's open it up to callers. David, do you want to explain how they can get in the queue?
Yes, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, the floor is open for your questions. If you would like to ask a question, you may do so now by pressing star 1 on your touchtone phone. We'll be taking questions in the order they are received. If at any time you need to remove yourself from the questioning queue or your question has been answered, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 now. Give it just a moment for people to queue up. And our first question comes from Charles Lane with the Washington Post.
Hi. Thanks for a good presentation by both of you. I wanted to ask a question that it may seem a little small bore, but it struck me that I always mispronounce his name, Mr. Tsipras, had an editorial in the German press today protesting that actually the Greek pensions are not so out of line. And his basic point was the reason they loom as such a large percentage of our GDP is not that they're so overly generous, but that that the GDP has collapsed. And that it's therefore, it's not even the elderly who are living off these pensions anymore, but the children of the elderly because they have no jobs. And I must say, I thought his defense of the Greek pension programs, which I've been inclined to regard as sort of terribly managed and extravagant, was surprisingly credible. I wonder if you guys have any thoughts on that point, because this is obviously a huge sticking point in the talks.
I just make a small point, and maybe Rob has a more substantive and impressive one. My small point is to say that if Tsipras is reduced to defending the pension payments by saying that this is an important way for the unemployed kids of the retirees to be supported, I mean, that's a pretty strange conception of what a pension program is supposed to do. You can make a separate argument that at a time of very high youth unemployment, that youth unemployed need to be supported. But obviously a pension payment, locks you into paying that retiree, forever until they die. And hopefully the depression in Greece won't last that long. So I heard the same argument, not just from Tsipras in his op-ed, but also there was a very revealing interview on BBC this morning with the chief Greek negotiator, who is a formidably articulate and persuasive guy with a, went to high school in Britain and, uses that to persuade the British radio listening public to great effect of his arguments. He made precisely the same point, but I didn't think it was one of his best ones.
Yeah, so Charles, I would sort of throw out two numbers to start off with. So pension expenditures are 16% of GDP. You're right to say GDP has been crushed by the recession, but that still is an extraordinarily high number. That requires 10% of GDP each year government transfer to the pension system to close the gap. And what that means is that if you take the pensions and the wages together, you're talking about three-quarters of primary spending. It is squeezing out everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the core of the problem. You're right to also say it's part of a social safety net, which is not targeted, is very broad, and has strong disincentives to work. And so I think one of the things that the Commission's been sort of felt they've been a little misrepresented on in this debate is they're not arguing for cutting the amount of the full retirement pension. They feel you can take this thing from 16% of GDP to 15% by essentially, putting in reasonable retirement ages and eliminating some of the opt-outs for very early retirement, and otherwise kind of reforming the system in ways that could probably save a decent bit of money. And the problem is, unless you're going to find someone to finance large and continuing deficits, you can't allow this much of your spending to go to these two items. And I think that is the inconsistency in the argument they're making.
Yep. Thanks.
Our next question comes from Dale Ponikvar with Milbank.
Hi. I'm a retired Milbank partner that was involved in representing the creditors committees in Lehman, Enron, and representing the debtor in long-term capital management. And what strikes me about the discussion is, and the press coverage, is that it's Greece versus Germany and other nation states. the FT points out this morning that 18% of the Greek debt, without defining Greek debt, is held by private parties, not by governments. And I'm kind of curious just to know the details here a little more, because that's usually where the devil and the solutions lie. It's kind of like who owes what to whom. In other words, there are the Greek banks, there's the Greek government, there's the German government, and then there are German banks, although my understanding of the German situation, at least, is that the German government had bought out, or if you will, bailed out the German banks of their Greek debts, and by and large. Who owes what to whom? And, you know, that the concept that there's one trigger date would make sense if there were just one borrower, because there'd be all kinds of cross defaults. But if you've got multiple borrowers with different loans, I would imagine that the D-Day for the different lenders is different. Can you comment on that?
After the 2012 private debt restructuring, it's been the case that the vast majority of the external debt is official, and mainly European claims and IMF claims on Greece. And that's why the focus of these negotiations has been on that. Those payments, except for the IMF payments, the European payments have already seen low interest rates applied to them and an extension of maturity. So the actual payments due on that debt are relatively modest relative to the size of the debt. Still, if you look at debt outstanding, that is the largest piece of it. And so it's been the focal point of the Greek negotiations on debt relief. In terms of the deadlines and when things, it isn't as clean as maybe it's sometimes portrayed. There has been a lot of focus on this IMF payment that is due on the 30th. It was actually due earlier in the month, but the fund has allowed the Greeks to basically bundle all the payments due this month and pay them at the end. If they miss the payment to the IMF, that in principle could trigger cross defaults to other official claims, including the ESM, but that's, I believe, at the discretion of those lenders. So you could be the day after they miss their IMF payment, the world does not have to come to an end. It really will be a political judgment by the creditors whether they essentially use that as a trigger to say we cannot continue the current financing arrangements, and what Sebastian said earlier about the particular bind that puts the ECB in because of all the collateral they hold is particularly important there. But it could drift for a while if Greece was running a primary surplus, in other words, if they had a surplus net of interest payments, they could, in a sense, stop paying on their external debt and still meet essential domestic payments. I believe that's not the case. I believe they have now a significant primary deficit if you include all the arrears they're generating. And so even if there was forbearance by official creditors and they didn't, in a sense, accelerate everything and call a default, you still probably would have huge pressures. You still would have huge pressures on the government because of the difficulty making domestic payments. And then the arrears that are generating would, I think, is already causing a cascading problem in the economy. And so the scenario in which we're looking at bank controls and capital controls and rising arrears is one which probably can't go on very long, even if there is forbearance on the external debt. But it is a kind of floating deadline, and it's hard to say that it's all over on a certain day.
Can I ask you to focus a little bit on the difference between who the borrowers are? Because I take it there are both mm-hmm. the Greek government and the Greek banks, because we're talking about the Greek banks being declared insolvent. Would that be because
a large part of the Greek bank balance sheet are government bonds. They are, in essence, on the margin, they are being financed by this ELA assistance from the ECB, European System of National Central Banks. And so if they can't roll that, that's, in a sense, an immediate cause of insolvency. In that sense, I think people do presume the government stands behind those banks to the extent it can, and I don't know if that answers your question.
It's a step there. it just strikes me that the process of simplification of what, mm-hmm. It's largely presented Greece versus Europe / Germany, and then that changes the whole tone of the discussion about, you know, should hardworking Germans be supporting lazy Greeks, and that's certainly the discussion going on in Germany today.
Well, and supporting has two elements, right? It has there's a question of debt relief, and I think there is a broad sense, a broad perception that there will need to be ultimately be debt, you know, some significant debt relief from the official sector to put Greece on a sustainable path within the Eurozone. But then there's the question of what kind of ongoing financing should the Europeans reasonably be asked to provide. And I think that is, in some sense, the harder argument for the Greeks to make right now, that they should be in a... Because I would argue that the policies that they are prepared to run would generate medium-term deficits that would require additional financing, right? And the resistance of Europe to do that is why I think there's such strong insistence on these set of reforms in pensions and wages and the social safety net.
Thank you.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press *1 at any time. Our next question comes from Michael Mosetig with PBS Online NewsHour.
Mike Mosetig here. Sebastian sort of touched on this, but to what extent can you, particularly when the political leaders get together, whenever they get together, sort out the political issue of the damage to Europe if Greece collapses versus all these technical issues that the financial people are dealing with? Sebastian, I think, has implied, if I understand correctly, that the problems are so immense now and the deadline is so close that even if the political leaders, particularly Merkel, wanted to take this out of the hand of the financial people and come up with a big deal, that they can't. But again, the basic point is, how do you sort out the political issue of a Greek collapse from all the economic issues or financial issues?
Mike, I think what you're saying is, you know, this is the one ray of hope in the whole picture, is that if you think about it, you know, from a financial perspective only, and you're sitting in Germany and you're the finance minister, you would probably end up with the same view that the real finance minister has. In other words, Wolfgang Schäuble's view is that Greece should have left a long time ago, you know, there's no use throwing good money after bad to these guys. And since the European Central Bank has succeeded in controlling the level of sovereign interest rates in the other troubled economies in Europe, there's kind of a firewall, and you can afford to let the Greeks go, and the Spanish and Portuguese and so forth would be okay. So that's his view. And the chances of kind of holding this thing together lie more from Merkel, who has a broader perspective. She's dealt a lot directly and in person with Vladimir Putin. She doesn't love the idea that, you know, Putin would be presented with a gift if the Greeks were thoroughly, you know, even more than they already are, alienated from their West European partners and would sort of fall into the arms of Russia. Tsipras made this high-profile trip to Moscow in April and, you know, denounced European sanctions on Russia when he was there. And so you can easily see how geopolitically this would be a gift to the Russians. And Merkel doesn't want that. And so maybe she would try to overrule Schäuble, the finance minister, and push Europe into a more conciliatory position towards Greece. The problem is that, you know, she would probably face a revolt in her own party. She already didn't get all of her CDU-CSU conservative coalition last time around when they voted on aid for Greece. She would get less of it now. Schäuble is known publicly to be, you know, not on her side on this. The Bundesbank is not on her side on this. The media in Germany are highly critical of Greece. And so, you know, the Bild-Zeitung, the sort of the tabloid media voice there is, you know, highly aggressive on pushing Greece out. And, you know, so basically, you know, Merkel would be going up against the tide of opinion in her own country. And it would be, it's not clear that she's going to you know, her foreign policy side may wish to avoid giving Putin this gift. At the same time, her domestic political antenna would tell her that she's making a mistake if she takes Greece's side in this.
Our next question comes from Charles Lane with the Washington Post.
Thank you. I wanted to just ask something of a follow-up on that, which, well, more like a follow-up on the previous question to that, which has to do with the distribution of this debt among official and private sector creditors. Is it necessarily the case that because the debt is concentrated now in the hands of official creditors, and including the ECB, that there has to be any kind of a, you know, they have to mark this to market, they have to take a hit to the ECB capital? Does any of that have to happen in the short run? And if so, how does that affect, you know, how it plays out? I hope that's a good
yeah, Sebastian may know that the institutional parts better than I do. My understanding is, for the most part, there are not mark-to-market requirements on the official credit, and so there is an element of forbearance that can come into play in an environment where the, at least where a deal was perhaps expected, and maybe the politics aren't, were not as toxic as they are currently. The one possible exception to that, the one exception to that is the point that Sebastian mentioned earlier, that so when the ECB extends credit under the ELA, this emergency lending facility, they collect collateral from the Greek banks. And that collateral primarily are government bonds. And they collect essentially 100 for every 80 cents they give under the current rules. And while they don't explicitly mark that to market, there's clearly a lot of attention paid to that. I think there is a political mark to market on that. And if you had broad non-payment by Greece, including on their government debt broadly, you know, it's going to be very hard for the ECB not to acknowledge that that collateral fell short of the value of what they have out to Greece, into Greek banks. And I think that's a forcing event. And that's why I think that can't go on very long. Is that a direct mark-to-market in the kind of literal financial sense? No, but I think practically it's pretty close.
Well, and just in the same vein, you know, Sebastian alluded to Schäuble's view that they've sort of, I hope I'm paraphrasing you correctly, Sebastian, they sort of sorted out the other basket cases to the point where they're fairly confident that they won't, there won't be that kind of contagion. Is he, notwithstanding what the geopolitics of that might be, is he right about that? In other words, that you know, Italian bonds will continue to be okay, and Spanish bonds, and so forth, and that this really is now just confined to Greece.
I think he is right. I think you know, that you've got a position where the. You've got a position where the Greeks are, sorry, where the European Central Bank has already been in crisis fighting mode for a while, and therefore it's not like Lehman, where, you know, people weren't, you know, the Fed was not sort of, you know, already in the mode of emergency liquidity in all directions, and so there was a bit of, you know, there was a week or 10 days of complete meltdown and mayhem after Lehman. If you imagine a case where, you know, the Fed had already been in the mode of handing out large amounts of liquidity to everyone in sight before Lehman, then, you know, the Lehman shock would have been much smaller. So, you know, it's always tough before these events to be sure about this, and there could be something, like Rob said, where the risk shows up in some place you didn't expect it, you know. Equities is a very kind of plain vanilla one, but there might be some fancier, you know,
FX derivative markets, for example.
Yeah. Right, yeah. where you'd see it. So it's, you know, never say never, but I think that in the big game of kind of government borrowing costs, I would bet that Schäuble's right.
Well, if I may follow up just one more thing on the geopolitics. And you gave an answer respecting Russia, which is sort of like the eastward side of that. Think about the westward side for a moment. So is one interpretation of the German stance here that they see a sort of the specter haunting Europe of populist parties generally, and that Syriza is the first one to actually gain power in any country, and that part of what their agenda is here is just showing that that can't get you anywhere, that electing that kind of government won't lead you to any kind of concession or indeed any kind of success.
Yeah, that's clearly right. I mean, you know, I think the Germans have, you know, a couple of reasons to take a hard line on this. The first is domestic political opinion and not wanting to throw money at the Greeks who are viewed as undeserving. And the second is not wanting to encourage other Syriza-like parties like Podemos in Spain, because obviously if you cut the Greeks a sweet deal, then the Spanish will be lining up and wanting the same thing.
Right. Thank you.
At this time, we have no other questioners in the queue.
So this is Adam. I'll just ask sort of a summing up question, and then I think we'll let everyone go. So if this is something like the end of the chapter on this, I mean, if in the next few months where, you know, Greece finds a resolution, maybe not a great one, but it is resolved. Can you just think about what this says, you know, for the years and decades to come? We talked about Lehman. We talked about a little bit about our own financial crisis here in the U.S., and we're still figuring that out. But does this mean the euro as a project is over? Does this mean, you know, massive currency unions are over? Does this strengthen them because now we have a better sense of what the edges are and how to structure these things better? Is there a moral hazard issue here that will be improved if we actually finally, in this financial crisis, see real pain to people who actually lent money to insolvent institutions? Can you just think about what the long-term implications are?
I'll go first, Matt. I'm skeptical of these arguments that Greece's exit is the end of the European project or of the euro generally. I think you could well see, particularly given it's likely to be a very painful exit for the reasons Sebastian's noted. You know, I don't think other countries are going to look at that and see that as a desirable path. I think it could well, you know, address some of these moral hazard concerns, strengthen the commitment and consistency of policies across other countries, and end up. I think it would probably have a freezing effect on new country on other countries joining the euro. I mean, if you're sitting there in Poland, you don't want to have anything of the euro. That will remain even be more so after this. But I see no reason why this couldn't work out in a way that ultimately strengthened the eurozone for the rest of the countries. I still think there's some fundamental issues that have to be addressed, in particularly fiscal union, if you're going to have a resilient and sustainable monetary union. But we might be making a step closer to that, not further away from it with this.
Yeah, I agree with what Rob said. There's a view out there that says this would be terrible if Greece left for the European project because, you know, what you would show that somebody can leave, and so instead of it being an irrevocable currency union, it would be a sort of, you know, so long as it works kind of union. And therefore, the moment somebody got into trouble, the markets would bet more aggressively that they're going to leave, and you'd see, you know, a sort of devastating run on the country, which would make the whole thing very brittle. So that's the view that says, you know, this is disastrous. But I tend on balance to the other view, which is basically it says, look, you know, what happened after the Asian crisis in 97, 98? Well, what happened was that having gone through that, emerging markets took the lesson that you better accumulate reserves and you better, you know, protect yourself from the next time. You don't want the IMF coming to you with 733 conditions, including sort of, you know, breaking your clothes market or something. I mean, there's detailed prescriptions that were imposed on Indonesia and, you know, the government wound up falling. So other emerging market governments, you know, saved a lot, accumulated massive central bank reserves and generally adopted somewhat better macro policies to avoid the same vulnerability, and I think you'd have a similar sort of turn towards prudence in the eurozone if Greece p- painfully exited.
I did have one last question. Sorry, can you just talk about what life is going to be like for Greeks, not the government, but the average Greek? I mean, they've lost something like 30% of their per capita income. They're about a third poorer than they were 5-6 years ago. What do you imagine the next decade holds, the next 20 years for them?
I think if they do end up, you know, in the scenario we're talking a lot about, in which you have banking controls, a disorderly adjustment process that ultimately leads an exit, I think there's going to be a extraordinarily large further adjustment in living standards that's going to have to take place. Greece doesn't really have a strong and well-diversified tradable goods sector. I think the real exchange rate has to fall a very long way to make Greece competitive. And, you know, I think often people compare this to the example of Argentina, where you had a significant exchange rate fall, but you also then had in 2001, 2002, but then you also had a pretty material rebound in activity and trade. I think it would be much harder to get that. And so I think the exchange rate, you know, the new exchange rate would have to be much depreciated relative to where we are now.
I mean, the other thing about Argentina is that Argentina, you know, had a peso that was linked to the dollar, but there were pesos in circulation, and so contracts between companies were often written in pesos, and when the dollar link snapped, there was a sort of functioning set of contracts, a functioning currency that the country could fall back on. Greece doesn't have that, doesn't have a drachma. Every contract is written in euros, and if it leaves the euro, then people are going to be fighting about which currency do you repay in. And so I think the chaos factor will be much, much bigger than it was in Argentina. And I think the first result will be that any Greek who is mobile will leave, because the economy will be in a total mess. And so the most sort of, you know, talented, ambitious, and educated, even more than is the case already, will leave the country, and that will be extremely bad for medium to long-run growth prospects. And I think it, you know, a really sustained negative spiral couldn't be ruled out.
All right. I'd love to end on a positive note, but I guess the truth won't let us do that. So thank you both. I found this truly fascinating and a very, very helpful conversation. Thank you. I know all the other folks on the call are sending their thanks as well. Thank you, guys. And thanks to everyone who tuned in.
Thank you, Adam.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's presentation. You may disconnect your phone lines, and thank you for joining us this afternoon.